You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
My guest today is Olga Kazan, who is a staff writer for The Atlantic and the author of Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. She has also written for The New York Times, Los Angeles Times, The Washington Post, and Vox. She got a new book. It's called Me, But Better, The Science and Promise of Personality Change. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with.
Olga Kazan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I had hoped to start this interview with the results of my scores on personalityassessor.com, which is the website created by Southern Methodist University professor Nathan Hudson. But that site has been down for repair since I started reading your book and all the way through. So that's like 4 weeks, man. And
wow.
It keeps saying, if you go there, it says, we're down for repair. We should be up any day now. So that kind of bummed me out.
Oh, no. Okay.
Yeah. But can you tell us about that site and how you found yourself interested in your particular scores?
Yeah. So a personality assessor normally is a site where you can take personality tests, and they're not like the BuzzFeed quizzes of yore or whatever. It's not like, which Hogwarts house are you? It's a real bona fide test that tells you where you fall on across five different traits, sort of how you would rate your personality. And it is designed, as you said, by a psychology professor. So this is based on real research that psychologists have done that's been replicated a lot. So it is pretty trustworthy when you can access it. So I got interested in this because I had just noticed over the years that there were a lot of things about my life that I wasn't crazy about. And mm-hmm. a lot of it was based around the way I reacted to situations. It wasn't necessarily what specifically was happening, but it was more just my reaction to the things that happened. And as I have this job where I cover a lot of social science research and psychology and things like that. And as I was learning more and more about personality and the research behind personality, I was like, oh, there's a way to change the way that you react. There's a way to change your outlook on things, a way to change your habits and behaviors. And all of that kind of falls under personality change.
Yeah. And so this isn't Myers-Briggs. It wasn't invented by witches. It is. And what they've identified, and I called up my various behavioral science and neuroscience friends to be like, what seems good? And they, this sort of big five personality traits people tend to think is a pretty good gauge right now. I'm sure decades from now, they'll find something else to go by. But what are the big five?
Sure. So the big five, you can remember them with the acronym OCEAN. Yep. So it's openness to experience, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism, which is a bad thing. The positive one, like positive opposite to neuroticism, is emotional stability, but they already had an E. So neuroticism is in there as well.
and that's the one I think you had the biggest issues with, right?
Yeah, and it's honestly the one that a lot of people say that they want to change. A lot of people struggle with it. It basically encompasses depression and anxiety, which any therapist will tell you is the first thing people say as far as why are you seeking therapy? You know, so that was definitely the thing that I struggled with most. I scored really high on it when I took my first personality test. And that was the thing that I wanted to do something about.
You have a line early in the book where you say, quote, understanding yourself can be freeing, even if the first step towards freedom is realizing you're trapped. I put that on my LinkedIn because I thought it was so profound. And I just had so many people respond with things like, oof, or I feel seen and not in a good way.
Are you okay?
Are you okay? Exactly. So, and I mean, you're such a good writer. You're also very funny, which is something I think is important inside this book, is you're navigating this thing that is fairly vulnerable with regard to yourself and your journey. And this started as an article, right, in The Atlantic, and then became a book?
Yes. Yeah, it started as an article. I would say that for the article, I did not totally give some of these things like a fair shake. Like, it was more of like a human guinea pig kind of experiment type thing. So for the book, I really dove deep. I went into all the traits. And I also looked into like traits that I actually am pretty good on. But that other people, you know, might want to improve on or change about themselves, like conscientiousness. So, yeah, it's not just, the article plus like, you know, my notes or whatever.
I remember when we started working with the behavioral science community, the idea of faking it until you make it as an idea around science, which would seem absurd to someone, I think at first, is kind of a thing in terms of, and that's what you discovered through this. Like, if you're an introvert, a way to be extroverted is by doing extroverted things. It's not a magic formula inside you.
Yeah. So it is interesting that like Nate Hudson, the personality assessor guy, he's done all this research, on personality change. He's done all these studies and like one of them has a line in it that's like faking it until you make it seems to work. And honestly, yeah, it's essentially like, so especially for introversion and extroversion is a really good example of this. If you feel like you're too introverted, maybe you feel socially isolated, lonely, like you don't have enough social connections, you really can just go out there and talk to people. And these don't have to be especially good interactions. You don't have to be especially interesting in them. They don't have to be life-changing. They will just gradually make you feel more extroverted, happier, and more socially connected just by doing them. So it really is something where like you have to like quote unquote do the work. But you honestly don't even have to feel that great about it the whole time.
And you tackled extroversion first. And as I told you, I did not know the task you assigned yourself before I booked you for the podcast, but you took an improv class.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I took improv. I felt like it would be, full immersion, kind of just like go in there, you know, and do the most extroverted thing possible. I honestly like wasn't even very familiar with improv when I started. But yeah, that is what I did.
I remember there was an Atlantic Festival here in Chicago last summer, two summers ago, that I did a presentation and we were out in the courtyard and I made everyone improvise and it went really well. And afterwards, people were coming up and talking to me and Derek Thompson was there and he sort of introduced me. But the common refrain I got was like all of them went like white as ghosts when they heard that they had to improvise. But then afterwards, they're like, actually, that was fun.
Yes. Yeah, I feel like that's the most common, the level of fear in the room that first improv class was just like palpable. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. When you could just feel how scared everyone is, including
the
yourself.
The flock sweat, you can smell it.
Yeah, it's, like everyone is just like, oh my God, is it too late to back out? You know, and like, but then at the end, we were all sort of like, you know, having a good time and chatting and had like loosened up. It's really remarkable how that happens.
Well, I love as a reporter, then you go back and learn about Viola Spolin and the foundations of this work. And Viola's granddaughter, Aretha Sills, is a dear friend of mine. I just talked to her last week, told her about the book. And it's because then you're like, oh, this kind of makes sense in terms of play and the importance of play with regard to human beings and learning and socializing and all these things. And I think because so many famous comedians come out of improv, people then think, oh no, this is about me being funny all the time, as opposed to me being me and that being amusing.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I really like that, you know, as you probably know, the history of improv is not necessarily one of people trying to be funny or that even being the goal. It was, you know, based around kind of immigrants and helping immigrants communicate better. And then also children, you know, literally called theater games for the classroom. You know, and so you do have this sense of like helping you just like kind of break out of what you would normally do or what you would normally say in a situation. And it often like the best scenes are ones where people are not going into it trying to be funny. Like it's more about funny things happening as it unfolds, which I also found surprising because I sort of always thought that like, well, if you don't have like a script that's funny, then you're never going to be funny. But that didn't turn out to be the case.
In chapter four, you say, quote, "Neuroticism is a personality trait for sure. But for me, it was a heavy shroud that obscured my vision and smothered me slowly." So talk a bit about your relationship. And this probably goes back generations, right, in your family?
Yeah, you know, I don't know how much like epigenetics, it's gone back and forth as far as like people thinking that it's valid and people thinking that it's not valid. But this idea that trauma can get passed down intergenerationally. And so I am Jewish and a lot of my family was affected by World War II and like both being prisoners of war and also being Jewish. And so I wonder sometimes how much of my anxiety about things is sort of just like based around the fact that like the most horrible things imaginable happen to some of my direct relatives. I have had a very charmed life by comparison. I have nothing of the sort going on in my world, but a lot of my reactions are, I noticed, and this is what prompted the personality change, is that a lot of my reactions were kind of unrealistic and they were kind of making the situation worse. Like something kind of inconvenient would happen and I would have like a huge meltdown about it, you know? And it was, I sort of started to notice this, that it's not like bad things happen to me. It's like, I would kind of make them worse with my anxiety and my, reactions.
I feel like generational trauma feels pretty true. I think what happens, of course, is people take it and then apply it to every single thing or take it off into another place. I did EMDR with my therapist once, and it was very powerful in sort of uncovering stuff that, you know, I wasn't even sort of, you know, conscious of at the top with regard to my parents had this terrible, both of them, terrible childhoods. And mine was a much more charmed, you know, situation. But it's very, you know, You say this in the book somewhere in terms of like as a child hearing the screaming and that sort of thing, you don't forget it, right? You don't you grow up with the ghosts that your parents had as well. And so you tried out meditation, which you and I are on the same page. It's something that I totally get. I think is great for people. I tried it and it didn't feel like it was it for me. And you kind of had that sensation as well, though your score improved.
Yeah. So this is the weirdest part. I did every kind of meditation. Like no one can say that there's some meditation out there that I haven't tried. I did every variety of it. I did MBSR, which is like this science tested, like rigorously tested type of meditation where you meditate for 45 minutes a day and you do all this other mindfulness homework and stuff. And I really didn't like it at all the whole time. A lot of people in my class warmed up to it and they were sort of at the end had touchy feelies and were like, I'm going to keep doing this every day for the rest of my life. I hated sitting there doing nothing for 45 minutes. There was one day where we meditated all day. That was really rough. But at the end, I took another personality test and it found that my depression score under neuroticism had gone way down. That I was was less depressed than most people, which is, I think, not something that has ever been true of me in the past. And I don't know. I honestly don't know how it works. Like, this is another thing where, like, I would talk to my meditation teacher about it, and I would say, like, I really hate meditating. You know, I'm really, I don't like this, what you're doing. I actively, you know, oppose this. And she was like, yeah, like, maybe just embrace that feeling, like, embrace not liking it. And, you know, and I don't know, maybe there's some weird witchcraft about it where, like, even if you don't like it, it still works.
See, I think it's completely true. That, I think because I hate it. I hate it. I don't practice it. I had some high blood pressure. And my therapist said, why don't I do this? Why don't I make a meditation tape for you? And I'm like, I don't want to do that. And she's like, no. It's just going to be like 14 minutes. And all you got to do is lay down, listen to this thing for 14 minutes, and then retake your blood pressure. Every time I did it, blood pressure dropped by like 10 points.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Do you find that you do, like, I love listening to music. I like putting on candles in the morning, different things like that. Is there other things that you do that might be considered meditation, except they're not meditation?
So I do yoga.
Okay, that's...
And that is one where, so we did do yoga in this MBSR class, and it's seen as a form of meditation. Now, the type of yoga that they do is so slow. Like, if you've ever been to, like, Core Power or something like that, yeah. It's not that. It's like, now move your hand, like, 5 minutes later. Now move your other hand. And so it does require a level of patience. But, you know, I will say that when I first started doing yoga, I was actually in high school, and I really couldn't stand it. I thought it was too slow. And I had that same feeling like I have about meditation now, where I was like, what's the point of this? Like, obviously, I was in high school, so my body didn't need all these stretches that it needs now. But, you know, I have gradually gotten really into yoga, and now I do it, and I, like, welcome, you know, an hour of not having content, you know, delivered to me. Like, I'm just thinking and moving. So to me, that is a form of mindfulness, and is something that has sort of grown on me, even when I didn't really think it would. So maybe meditation would too, if I could actually stick to it.
I sense you're not going to, and I'm not going to. Okay. Openness to experience. So you and I are both people, I think, who would probably write pretty high on that. You're a journalist. I'm a theater guy. So what did you do to, like, tackle that?
So this was challenging because I already am really open to experiences, yep. And I was before I started, and there wasn't really a lot of room to go up. But there is some sort of evidence in the literature that certain activities can promote openness to experience. And one of them is travel and exercise. So I combined two of those at one point. I went surfing, which I had never done before. So that kind of checked the, like, new experience box. And it was in Costa Rica, so new country. And that was, the Costa Rican element was less significant because our instructor was an American who just happened to live in Costa Rica. Mm-hmm. But the fact that it was surfing was really interesting, and I think did help, like, increase my openness a little bit, because I was a little bit scared of it. Like, I was a little bit, like, nervous about doing it, because you are just, like, in the water, and, like, you know, you have to be a really
strong.
You could get hurt, yeah. I mean, not really what the kind we were doing, but, like, conceivably, as you get better and better, you could get injured. And I don't know, to me, that was something where, like, I had to push past that, like, I could get hurt feeling. And it just requires a lot of concentration to surf. Like, it is, it's very cognitively demanding, because you have to, like, predict the wave, kind of how it's going to go, and, like, get in it at the right angle. So that one I found, I was like, okay, this is a good activity for someone who really wants to get out of their comfort zone. And, you know, really wants, like, some crazy new experience, because it just scratches so many different itches when it comes to, like, you know, challenging, scary, fun, you know, also very cognitive, and not just, it's not just for people who are, like, super buff and physical.
So let's talk about agreeableness. So you scored about average on that.
Yes.
did that surprise you or not surprise you?
Yes and no. So agreeableness has a couple different facets, and the one that I score high on, or I tend to score high on, is empathy for other people. But the one I tend to score low on is trust for other people.
Okay.
And I think that's honestly part of being a journalist. Like, that kind of is a descriptor of journalism, is like, you're very empathetic and you're like, oh my gosh, like, I can't believe that happened to you. I want to write a story. But at the same time, you're like double checking everything they say and like running it back and like getting documents and stuff to verify it. That's, I think, why it came out about average.
So we just interviewed the Harvard professor, Alison Wood Brooks, on her book called Talk, which is about to have, basically, it's the science of conversations and how to have in conversations. And you talk about this in this chapter, and you actually, I think you went to England, right, to meet with Georgie Nightingale, who leads classes in this?
Yes. Yeah, she, so I, it was funny, I get to London and I have to like tell people why I'm there, because like that's what you have to do in the airport. And I like didn't think about that. And so I get there and the like, whatever, British version of TSA is like, why are you here? And I was like, I'm going to a workshop. And he's like, what kind of workshop, terrorist? And I'm like, I'm going to a conversation workshop. And he just starts laughing. And I was like, great. And I got that reaction a lot, actually, because, you know, someone, I was like waiting in line for a restaurant and the hostess asked me why I was there and stuff. So yeah, it was kind of a strange thing to have a workshop on, but that is what I did.
Well, and the great thing about that, too, and this goes into, you talk about Nick Epley, and of course, my audience knows we had a 5-year program at the University of Chicago working with Nick and other scientists. And in particular, there was the study that Nick did where he sent graduate students out on public transportation in Chicago to have conversations with strangers. And Nick then turned to my wife, who is the head of this program, and said, can you create an improv exercise that would allow people to practice this experience? So we actually created an improv exercise called Universal Unique. And in the exercise, you have a conversation with your partner about like grocery shopping. But your first part of that conversation has to be universal, like human beings grocery shop like this. And you have that conversation. And then you do that for about a minute. And then we say, okay, now think about how you personally grocery shop. Have that conversation. People are... they're so confused about how they got so deep so quick simply because they shared personal details about themselves in something as banal as grocery shopping.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're having a conversation, those kinds of details do reveal things, whether we like it or not, because we're just being honest about who we are. And let's be honest, we all kind of are weirdos when we grocery shop.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, that was what was so interesting about Georgie's workshop, is that I noticed that conversations can often be improved by just asking what an experience meant for someone, like, oh, and why was that meaningful? Or like, why was that interesting? Or why is that hard? Like even just asking that follow-up question instead of just how was your flight or how was your drive down, you know, whatever. It honestly just opens up so many new avenues and like interesting, I don't know, more interesting conversations, I would say, than what the kind of small talk that I think people who don't like small talk don't like.
You as a reporter, though, have to do that, right? When you're interviewing people?
Yeah, but it's funny how that turns off when you're socializing.
Because you think it's inauthentic.
Yes, like you think people don't want that when they're having fun. But actually, that is fun. People like to do that. And yeah. I don't know. Epley also has some... research on how people think that like people won't like deep conversations, but they actually do really like them. So I don't really know how to reverse this misconception.
No, Alison talks about that in her book as well. And that people don't mind going deep rather quickly. It's just, you know, like anything, there's two people in the conversation. So you've got to be hyper aware of where the other person is at, because you're going to make all sorts of assumptions, and we're usually wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Also, because people withhold information and you also don't know what went on in their day day. And it could be, they could be completely different the next day, which is kind of the big portion of the book at the end, which is, you know, I think this is such a cultural thing for us, which is we like to think things are A or B. It's like true or false or whatever. And even a thing like personality, it does change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and you experienced that, right?
Yeah. I mean, I really feel like this book Okay, so there was like the test that I took throughout the book, and they did show change in my personality as a response to these various activities. But I think one of the biggest things that it did for me is that it really helped clarify that I wanted to have a child. I don't know if that like truly changed my. I don't know if that was, that's not like a facet, like having or not having kids or a trait or whatever, but it did kind of help me get to that point mentally. I don't know. I'll just leave that there. That's not related to science at all, but that's what it did for me.
Well, I think what, you know, where it is related to science is, you know, we're not rational human beings. And if you want a rational case, you're not going to have a kid. It's not fun.
No.
It's exhausting. It's expensive. You worry all the time. But also the research shows that at the end of the day, we thrive in terms of our relationships. We want purpose and meaning. And I don't know about you, but the thing I've learned, you know, and I'm older than you, so I've learned this over and over again, which is like nothing really great that ever happened to me came easy.
Yeah. Yeah, this book was a sort of a you can do hard things experience for me. And nothing I did in the book was as hard as having a child, which I have also since done. But it did kind of make me feel like, okay, a lot of this stuff that I thought was like super scary and impossible and just super daunting actually ended up being doable, or a version of it ended up being doable and like did not destroy me. So it was a little bit of a like stress test for difficult situations.
You were going to move to Florida in the book. That was a big thing.
Yes, that was actually I thought the book was going to culminate in me moving to Florida, but it culminates in me getting pregnant.
I think that's better. Why didn't you go?
There were just so many logistical hurdles to getting a house at the time. I mean, honestly, we're still planning to go. But I would say I had a healthier reaction to the failed search for real estate in Florida than I would have before I started the book. But I mean, interest rates had like tripled and there was like nothing on the market. And we were really trying to talk ourselves into like really crappy houses that we didn't really want. And we held off. But that was a huge, like most of the book is like, should I buy this house or not?
Yeah, no, I know. And like when they talk about the big things in life, right? Like marriage, having a kid, moving, all this. Like, I don't think you want to combine those. I think that's too much.
Yeah, exactly. And then we were like, yeah, once I got pregnant, we were just like down the funnel of like OBs and like setting up the nursery and all that stuff. So, but it's still on our vision board.
So I want to cover conscientiousness, and I thought it was this made sense to me after I thought about it, but it wasn't in the front of my brain when I first thought it. You read in the book, quote, because of its association with motivation and persistence, conscientiousness is the trait that best predicts professional success, and it's the one employers prize most. Okay, I think did that surprise you when you learned that, or no?
I think there's one kind of impression out there that employers really prize extroversion, that they really mm-hmm. like extroverted people. And I think that's true for some jobs, but conscientiousness is actually, I mean, it's just this trait that everyone wants. Like ultimately when you get down to like New Year's resolutions, like they're all about conscientiousness, basically, like losing weight, being on time, following through on stuff, like not picking up a million little projects and not finishing any of them. Like those are all conscientiousness, basically.
And, you know, in the book that you are a pretty conscientious person, but in part because you weren't always.
Yeah, this is something that for me really changed in my mid-20s, where I did have a tendency kind of in my late teens and early 20s where I was kind of late a lot. And part of this, honestly, was living in LA and not being a very good driver. So I would kind of get stuck in traffic a lot and run. I don't know. It was like very hard for me to predict how long it would take to get get places. And I was also very scatterbrained. Like I would forget where things were and forget what I was supposed to do, things like that.
There's a really, it's a short, lovely phrase that's towards the end of the book where you say, quote, "You hurt where you care."
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, so this is from Stephen Hayes and his acceptance and commitment therapy. And that is, it's a little hard to describe in a short period of time, but it's basically sort of just accepting that you will have bad feelings and sort of doing whatever you like value in life anyway. That is that kind of quote that he said, it basically just means that when you have painful or disappointing or frustrated feelings, it doesn't always mean you should just give up whatever caused those feelings. So if you've been, I don't know, trying to pursue some goal, some promotion at work or something like that, and you were rejected, that doesn't necessarily mean like, and you feel bad, that doesn't mean like you shouldn't ever try for that again, or like that wasn't the right thing for you to attempt. You know, maybe it means it was really important to you, and like that actually means that you should pursue that instead of giving up on it. It's kind of a simple thing, but I think it is a cognitive switch that is good to keep in mind. If you're someone who's a little bit prone to like sour grapes thinking.
It's also a thing that we skate around all the time. I think of all these phrases like follow the fear, seeing all obstacles as gifts, making mistakes work for you. It's this idea of it is not going to go right. And so if you know that going in, you can replace blame with curiosity. You can, it's such a healthier way of navigating the imperfect situations that we will find ourselves in, frankly, hour by hour. And like, again, this is an interesting thing about being someone in improv, so we all start when we're like, 19 or 20, and then we grow up, and those of us who stay, then have families, we're like, oh, this is really helping me with the parenting.
Yes.
It is. You have to find the game inside that situation or else you're going to be driven crazy.
Yes. Parenting is all improv. That's all I have to say about that. It is like one unending improv show, no audience, just you and someone who can't talk, but is somehow a master improviser.
Yeah. Both my kids took improv too. And my one son's a Shakespeare actor now. And he had to improvise for a thing the other week. And everyone was sort of like, you do that too? And he's not interested in being an improviser, but it's inside his bones. And he just knows to sort of play with what's in front of him. And I think he uses it off stage a lot because I always equate it. I say improv is like yoga for your social skills. It really gives you a practice in being able to sort of just be a little more easy with yourself in these social situations. I love the fact that one of your things that you did was host a party. And the anxiety with which you were dealing with hosting a party, which I was like, and I'm an extrovert, obviously, and don't have that same problem. But I really related. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's tough for some people.
Yeah, there's something about having people in your house. I really just don't do it that much. And like, mm-hmm. It really makes me so self-conscious about having people in my house. So I wanted to push myself to actually invite people over and see that like, nothing bad happens if you don't have like the very nicest house on the block. People will still come over, they'll still drink your beer, they'll have like a moderately good time, and then they'll leave. And like, the party won't go on forever. Like you won't have to like turn out the lights and like pretend to be asleep or whatever. Like it's, I think it was just another one of those things where the specter of it like loomed larger than the reality.
I love that one of your friends said to you, is this for the book or for you?
Yeah. People have been saying that a lot. Like, are you only friends with me for the book? Yeah. Yeah. Stuff like that. Yeah.
All right. So we always end the podcast asking our guests for a yes and story, which might seem odd given what we've always been, we've basically been talking about nothing but yes and this whole time, but I will still offer that up to you. Do you have a yes and story for us?
Yeah. It's my favorite scene from improv. I got paired with this guy. It was like a little quiet. He's like an accounting professor, and we had never done a scene together, and I was like a little nervous about it, and it was kind of like, how's this gonna go? And so we were improvising that we were going on a trip together. We were two friends at the airport getting ready for our trip together, and we were worried about whether something that was in our suitcase would get through TSA. And we were kind of going back and forth because neither of us could figure out the exact thing that it was. So we were like, yeah, I wonder if they're going to let it through. Yeah, well, they didn't let last time. Yeah, but we really need it for this trip that we're going on. Yeah, but like, you know, if they don't let us, we won't be able to buy another one there. And then this guy, who's like so not who you would expect to say this, said, yeah, every time we travel, we have to have one of those clowns that when you punch them, they jump back at you. And I was like,
yeah, that's
how did you, like, I don't even, that's like not anywhere in my brain at any given time. Mm-hmm. Like those clowns that you punch them and they jump back at you. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I would have expected like a gun before that. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, that's that sort of delightful element of surprise that you get and get an improvisation. If you know, the honest response is usually the best response to that.
Yeah. Anyway, don't underestimate people in improv.
The book is called Me But Better, The Science and Promise of Personality Change. Olga Kazan, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.